race to come down and threaten us.
Is the singularity near?
The military-industrial complex.
The truth is out there.
The seven mountains of the influencers of culture.
To be as gods, you know, catapult of propaganda.
From a mostly secure, undisclosed, split-level location on a cul-de-sac somewhere in the heartland of America, this is A View from the Bunker. Now, here's Derek Gilbert.
As harsh as this sounds, the elites want to kill you. Welcome to A View from the Bunker. I'm Derek Gilbert. A couple of years ago, I had the opportunity to interview Brent Miller Sr. at the Rocky Mountain International Prophecy Conference, and that was the title of his presentation, Why the Elites Want to Kill You. And I think with the research that we do, if you're a longtime listener to this program, that is sort of implied in a lot of what we talk about. But hearing it that bluntly is kind of jarring. That will in more or less be the topic of conversation today as we welcome back a guest we have not spoken to in quite some time. She's the author of a book titled Exile. It's the story of how an out-of-work reporter gets mixed up with a man who's not what he appears to be and then winds up living as an expat. She's also somebody who came back to our attention about 4 or 5 months ago. We talked to Charles Pascal about the issue of forced guardianship and how it is being used to drain the life savings of seniors against the wishes of those seniors and their families, because this is something that happened to her. And to be honest, until Charles mentioned her name again, I had forgotten that this was an integral part of her story. Without further ado, we welcome back to A View from the Bunker for the first time since 2006, Janet Phelan. Janet, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me back on your show, Derek.
So it is, it's sad in a sense that we need to discuss such disturbing topics, but, you know, there's no point in going through life with, the proverbial rose-colored glasses on, or rose-colored glasses, to just make everything appear something that it isn't. And that was, I guess, was the point of the gentleman who gave that presentation with the very direct title, Why the Elites Want to Kill You. Before we jump into this and the research that you're doing now on the bigger picture here, let's start a little bit with your backstory for people who may not be that deep into the archives going all the way back. Because I guess actually back in 06, it wouldn't have been A View from the Bunker. It would have been PID Radio, the show that Sharon and I have kind of put on hiatus now here this year because we're just too busy doing, you know, other things with Skywatch TV. But anyway, people who may not be that deep into the PID radio archives may not be aware of our previous conversation. And your mother and the story that led to the discussion with Charles Pascal about forced guardianship fraud. What was it that happened? And then how did, well, and what happened from there? I guess we'll get into that at the end of the, that.
Right. Corrupt guardianships is a topic that is finally beginning to hit the mainstream radar a little bit, although not quite, you know, with the resolution and to the satisfaction of those in the guardianship reform movement. Guardianships are initiated when there are, through court proceedings, when there are allegations that a person is lacking capacity or somehow can't take care of him or herself. Now, that on the surface, that all sounds really good. A guardian is appointed to take care of your affairs and to make decisions for you. However, in practice, what we're seeing is basically the takeover of a person's entire life to the detriment of the ward. Money goes missing, and very often when the money runs out, and this is the ward's money that is funding the guardianship, when the money runs out, very often the person is funneled into hospice, whether or not he or she is terminally ill, or simply withheld necessary medical care, and the person will die. And we're seeing this happen now on a massive scale in all 50 states. This group that is impacted by guardianship would be the elderly and disabled. And any eugenics program that we have seen operational in the past always targets the elderly and disabled. And given what is happening to these people in the U.S. now, and once again, you know, these are court-authorized guardianships. They They go through court proceedings. Judges are involved in facilitating these abuses. So, you know, what we're seeing is basically an attack on one of the most vulnerable groups in society, people who have incapacities or aging issues.
I'm thankful that my mother is still very active and nearing the age of 80 now, and she's still, she lives nearby. I see her a couple of times a week and able to keep very close tabs on what's going on with her. But I do see the attempts by people whose motives I question trying to get closer to her. To the point where there are times when I have to ask her to funnel calls to me, or I will make return phone calls to people who have left messages, you know, trying to find out, you know, what is it exactly you want with my mother? And it is hard to believe that this goes on. That was one of the things that kept coming. The reaction I had during the conversation with Charles back in February was that it was difficult to believe that our legal system, that our judicial system, our courts would facilitate this type of abuse, because it's not just a financial, as you point out, it shares aspects of eugenics programs where you try to eliminate the weak and the feeble and the infirm, and of course the elderly would often fall into that category. Why do the courts let this go on? Why are they facilitating this?
Well, my understanding, and I understand that my perceptions are somewhat controversial and certainly not shared by everyone who is in the guardianship reform movement, but my understanding is that this is a federal program. It is a federal, what is called underground program, that's being run through the state courts. And the federal program involves asset seizure and what retired attorney Ken Ditkowski has called elder cleansing. And Ken Ditkowski had been an attorney for over 50 years in Illinois and was suspended from the practice of law for his contacting the Department of Justice and asking for an honest and comprehensive investigation of the abuses going on in guardianship court. That was the end of his career. He was suspended from the practice of law by the Illinois Attorney Registration and Disciplinary Commission, and another Illinois attorney named Joanne Dennison had begun a blog about what's happening in these guardianship proceedings. And she was suspended from the practice of law for her blog. Apparently, attorneys don't have First Amendment rights and are now being suspended for criticizing the court. So in my case, my story has sort of a little different tweak to it, because as I discussed in my book that was recently published entitled Exile, there was a federal agent, and he is named in the book. His name is Jack Smith, not his real name, but it is the name he's been going under since the early 1990s. He was assigned to our family to micromanage the extermination of my mother. And I say this boldly without any fear of lawsuit or repercussion of a legal nature, because it is the truth, and there are documents that are provided in the appendix to my book Exile which bear Jack Smith's signature, which are incredibly self-incriminating. So in my situation, there was a federal agent who approached me romantically, wined me and dined me, you know, lured me essentially into a romantic relationship with them for the purposes of destroying my family. And now the question, of course, that one has to ask is, why did this happen? In guardianship corrupt guardianships, and there are now thousands of them, people forming groups, grassroots advocacy groups, Facebook groups, trying to grapple with the problem. I've never run into another case where a spy is essentially attached onto a situation in order to micromanage it. So there was an absolute other impetus behind my mother's situation. This was, and in fact, the whole MO of the guardianship did not proceed as guardianships usually do. The estate wasn't emptied out, and then my mother funneled off to an early grave. One of the first things that happened was an attempt on my mother's life by the guardian. And this is discussed and documented in my book, Exile. So it does appear to me that the federal government is perfectly aware that guardianships can, and with the, you know, right corrupt parties, you know, the bad guardian, bad attorney, bad judge, can and will turn lethal. And this can now be used as a means to attack a target family, which is exactly what happened in my case. And as one progresses through my book, one can see where, you know, I was not aware that Jack, who I was living with at the time, you know, I got enough pulled into the situation to be residing with him for a while. I was not aware that he was a federal agent. He had a cover job at an agency, a company, which I later had a private investigator look at, and also had the private investigator look as closely as possible at Jack Smith. And the PI came back and said, you know, why do girls contact me and think their boyfriends were, you know, mafia or FBI or something? And he says, in this case, you were right. And that company he works for, he says, it's a cutout.
Cutout.
It's not a bona fide agency. So there is enough documentation, external documentation in Exile, to, I believe, completely substantiate the allegations that my family was targeted by intelligence operatives for purposes that were not in any sense benign or benevolent.
Why would they target your family?
Well, I go into this in Exile, and I'm gonna hold off on delivering the punchline. I think
okay.
If people are interested, they can certainly read the book. There are also some there are some reviews available for the book. One particularly by Catherine Hine, which go into to some degree my perceptions of why this happened. And it, once again, it does tie into what I believe is a larger eugenics impetus, a covert impetus in the U.S. government. Something they don't want us to know about.
Well, let's dig into that then. You know, what is this larger agenda then that and what would the end game be?
Right. Well, let's just talk about a couple of the blips on the radar. First of all, we've got the adult guardianship blip. Okay,
right.
There you've got a group of what Hitler called the useless eaters, basically being robbed and thrown into, you know, into the trash heap. So we also have another blip, which is the police killings that are going on now, where police are shooting citizens and almost never being held accountable. And as we know, a large number of these police shootings are aimed at minority groups. Very often African-Americans. Also, I think a number of homeless people have been either shot or beaten to death by police with no culpability. Recently, the United States submitted to a review of its human rights record at the United Nations. Every, I think, 3 or 4 years, they have a cycle of countries that they review, and every few years, the U.S. pops up, and grassroots NGOs and other countries are invited to submit, you know, their concerns and comments, and the U.S. is given an opportunity to respond. I actually wrote an article about this last UPR cycle. You can find it at New Eastern Outlook, which is who I write for now. They're a news agency out of Moscow. And the article, I believe, is entitled Just Say Anything. The U.S. got up there in response to concerns and lied through their teeth. And one of the things they lied about was the accountability of police officers when they murder U.S. citizens. A delegate from the United States Department of Justice announced to the UN convention that that the Department of Justice had prosecuted over 400 abusive police officers in the time frame, you know, over the last few years between the last UPR cycle and this one. Over 400 cases, he announced. And I checked that out, and I spoke with law professors. I did my own search. The number of cases prosecuted could be counted on the fingers of one hand. Mm. They drastically and brazenly inflated the numbers beyond belief. And you, when one ran through other sorts of statements made in response by the U.S. delegation to criticisms of its human rights record, one found that in every case where there were numbers provided by the U.S. to talk about, you know, what they're really trying to do to fix the problems, in every case where there were potential subterranean eugenics issues or what looked like targeting a group of people, in every case, the U.S. drastically inflated its own report of its own record in order to, apparently, in order to divert concerns that the U.S. was treating groups of people unfairly. Now, eugenics always talks about groups, eugenics being a modification of humanity, okay? You, mm-hmm. Positive eugenics, you encourage certain kinds of people to have more children, right? Negative eugenics, you kill off the people you don't like.
Right.
And so, you know, what we've got now is becoming very clear to me. I mean, we basically have come into a time where certain groups and kinds of people bearing certain genetic or in other ways evidence of unfavorability, such as elderly and disabled, are being funneled into either an early grave or into situations where their rights are being dishonored. And, you know, when we see police just shooting black people, you know, because they look at them funny, which is basically how bad it's getting. And then there's no culpability, there's no accountability by the police officer. You know, one can question why that would be. Recently, I was at an expat dinner in Yucatan, and there were some bunch of different people there. I started talking with a fellow and I said, well, what do you do? And he said, well, I'm a retired police officer. I took early retirement. And he was still fairly young. I said, oh, really? He said, what do you do? I said, I'm a reporter. He goes, oh. And his eyes got big and his voice lowered. He said, well, then, you know what's going on up there. You know. Okay. So, I think that my perception, you know, through further conversation, he didn't want to be part of, you know, the big bad team who got to kill people with complete impunity. So he resigned after early retirement.
And I think that there are other aspects of this that are attempting to achieve the same result, but more efficiently. I mean, it's it is certainly one thing to kill one at a time. I think the it's my view that the real goal of the animosity between the police and the African American communities is to keep the United States so balkanized that we're too busy fighting one another to really see what the elites are doing. Meanwhile, while that's going on, for the most recent year that we have statistics, in New York City, more than half of the African-American children conceived in 2013 were aborted before they were born. So most of them aren't even, in places like New York City, aren't even seeing the light of day because of federal...
Because I did not know that. That's a shocking figure.
It is shocking, and I think whether one... Regardless of what one's views are on the abortion issue, that is a statistic that should make one stop and consider maybe this. There's more to this than simply a woman's right to choose, especially when you look at a quote from Judge Ruth Bader Ginsburg a few years ago, who said, well, we thought it was understood that Roe v. Wade was about making sure we didn't have too many of the kind of people, the wrong kind of people. And again, it does seem to be practiced much more frequently. And I'm not saying this with any kind of racial bias. I'm just looking at raw numbers from areas in which I've seen it. And I've not done an extensive study on this, but the numbers from New York City for 2013 were so startling. The Asian community is very rare. Caucasian Americans, it's much more practiced. But again, in New York City, more than half of the African-American children conceived in 2013 were aborted. That would seem to be a much more efficient and socially acceptable means of achieving this eugenic goal of winding up with a populace that looks more like what the elites want than doing it through the police. Because
I agree.
Again, the net result of what happens, even if it's now, it's to the point now where even if there is a confrontation in which the police can justify the use of deadly force, it doesn't matter anymore because the narrative has been established. Every shooting now is an unjustified shooting, regardless of the case. And of course, the militarization of the police forces here in the United States, which we saw in spades in my old neighborhood of Ferguson, Missouri, didn't live there long, lived there for a couple of years back in the late 80s and early 90s, and went to church in Ferguson. It was, to my view, it was a very charming, unique community with some wonderful century homes. And next thing I know, you know, after moving away, kind of lose track of things. And next thing I know, it's sort of like ground zero for Black Lives Matter. And whatever happens now between the police and the African-American community, which has a long history of grievances that are justified, they've got reason to be distrustful of the police. But like I said, regardless of how things take place from here on out, I don't see any peaceful resolution. And again, the only people I see benefiting from this are the elites who want to keep us distracted and fighting over these issues rather than paying attention to what they are doing to our food supply, to our money, our savings, and so forth.
I would take this a little further. In my perspective, I resonated to what you said about efficient ways of reducing the population in a targeted way.
Some of our conversations 10 years ago dealt with that issue, right?
Right, right. And it's my perspective that what we've been discussing, you know, what's happening with police shootings, what's happening with, you know, aborting certain kinds of people, what's happening with adult guardianships, the elder cleansing scenario, that these are indications of what of a change in policy that is not being openly revealed. And it is this change in policy that is going to end up, I think, with a scenario with a very efficient ways of killing people. And unlike many of my fellow independent reporters, I'm not in any way particularly entranced with this notion of using FEMA camps to put people in and kill them. I think that this may be a smokescreen. I think what we're looking at is a planned pandemic. This is a way that people can die off and possibly rather quickly, and that the United States and whatever other countries are complicit here can keep their public relations persona intact. Mm-hmm. You know, we did everything we could to help, and this terrible pandemic hit. Now, there are many indications that this is a very viable scenario. A number of government insiders, senators and so forth, have made public announcements stating, we expect a pandemic. And actually, the target date given in a lot of these announcements, the WMD Center in Washington, D.C. made these announcements and others did. The target date was 2013. And actually, in my book and in some of my articles, I discuss why this date, 2013, was affixed and what didn't happen in the global chessboard that could have facilitated this happening in 2013. Now, how can a pandemic be released and not affect the elite? There are two ways that this can happen. One is through specificity of agent. The other is through specificity of delivery system. Now, when I say specificity of agent, I'm talking about basically a gene weapon.
Right.
Now, we know that gene weapons are certainly, with the cracking of the human genome, we know that gene weapons are certainly a possibility.
They're certainly being researched, yes.
Well, they appear to have already been deployed. And I'm going to talk about one example where it does appear that gene weapons have been developed and deployed. There was a medical doctor back in the 80s who was working as research director for Project Coast in South Africa. His name is Wouter Basson. And he was developing all kinds of nasty biological and chemical resources in order to attack apartheid South Africa's enemies. And he was known to be working on developing what is called a blacks-only bioweapon. Now, the question is, was he successful at this? And he ain't talking, okay? However, other people are. And I interviewed a scientist who had worked alongside Wouter Basson, not in the same Project Coast biochem warfare unit, but actually was working in a nuclear project and was very conversant with Basson's work. And this scientist, he was very nervous and he wanted to help. He kept citing his security agreement with the South African government and, you know, and was trying to answer questions and was stopping himself. And finally I said, you know, I think Basson was successful at this. And he said, yes, I do too. I do too. And then I said, I think that what he was able to do was to find some agent, some sort of chemical agent that attaches onto melanin. People with darker skin have more melanin.
Right.
And I said, and I think that's how he approaches. And the guy looked at me and said, yeah, I think so too. Okay. Now, let's look at that hypothesis a bit. Because right after, concurrent basically with the time that Basson was doing this highly classified research for the South African apartheid government on developing a blacks-only weapon, very shortly thereafter, and this can be verified, through checking. Very shortly thereafter, the rates of diabetes and hypertension, the silent killers, began to spike with people of color. Okay. Now, I wrote an article on this also for New Eastern Outlook. It was published in 2014, and I did the research through the data, you know, through the databases on rates of diabetes and hypertension, and they went through the roof. Just within a few years after Project Coast basically was shut down by Nelson Mandela. So it is questionable, you know, and Bassan won't answer questions about his work on that. Now, how would this have been delivered? How would, you know, him finding something that produces, attaches onto a melanin and it produces diabetes and hypertension in people with more melanin, how would people get this, right? And I did have a source. I didn't just think of this on my own. I was approached by someone a number of years ago who was contending that this is what happened and that it was leaked into the food supply. Mm. Now, if you look at darker skinned populations that are still living close to the land and are not consuming food from corporate sources, you know, not eating Nestle, they're not eating, you know, all this other stuff that gets processed.
Cargill, ADM, or whoever else might be controlling the supply of processed foods.
If they're still, you know, living close to the land and eating off the land, their rates of diabetes and hypertension are flat. They have not spiked. When they move into the cities and they start eating corporate food, corporately produced food, the rates go shooting up through the ceiling.
Hmm.
So that article also, you know, that goes into some depth as to these statistics also appears on New Eastern Outlook. So this is one way that a gene weapon can be developed and covertly delivered.
Mm-hmm.
Another way, of course, is through vaccines. I think a lot of people are very concerned. They're rightfully so about vaccines. And another way is through the water system. And this is something I think that we talked about when I did your show 10 years ago.
Right.
I was just completing the first phase of my research on water systems in the U.S., and I was able to document with some shock and dismay that water systems throughout the United States have been reconfigured since around the work started in the early to mid 1970s to basically reconfigure and reconstruct water systems throughout the U.S. To basically provide a double line water system. And so I'm just going to give like a 2-minute recap on this, if that's
sure.
Okay.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Okay. So basically, if you're going to use water as a delivery system for a biological or chemical warfare, you're not going to want to dump something into a reservoir, because then everybody who drinks water or bathes in water or cooks in water is going to be, you know, get the contaminant. You're going to want, again, to be able to selectively deliver whatever you're dead set on giving to people who don't know that they're getting it. So in order to do so, you would have to have a second line. First line would have water. Second line would have swine flu, Ebola, you know, whatever, pick your poison, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And the systems would have to be configured so that whatever is in the second line is being withheld by remote control valves. I, once again, this is not a scenario that that I thought of myself, I was tipped off that this had happened. So I set about researching the possibility and was able to get blueprints and diagrams showing conclusively that in every sector, city in America that I looked at, this is what we now have. The systems, the water systems were reconfigured. A second line was put in with remote control valves that do withhold whatever is in the second line from going into selective main lines. So in America, in many cases, we have a melting pot. We have drug dealers living next door to rabbis, living next door to NSA agents. I mean, people are all mixed up, okay? And so if you're going to deploy something that is of this nature, you are going to want to do it selectively. So you maybe want to hit the drug dealer's house, let's say, okay, and forget about the rabbi and the NSA agent. So you can, with the system as it is configured, you can simply open up the remote control valve, which is satellite controlled, and this whatever is in that second line will go only into the drug dealer's house. Now, I've written a number of articles on this with documentation. There is a website called ROM Communications, which shows exactly how a system like this will work. You have a picture on one side of a cell phone or laptop. It shows how an impulse, a command that is entered on a cell phone or laptop can go into the internet. It goes up to a satellite, and then on the left-hand corner of the diagram, it will show what can be controlled or accessed in such a way. And there is that same water valve that has been placed on this second line in every city in America where I was able to get blueprints and where I was able to research this.
Makes me glad that
a couple of articles.
I was going to say, makes me very glad that we've got our own well where we are now.
Yes. I think well water may be the best thing that you can possibly have.
Yeah.
I just want to mention there are a couple of articles that are available online, and I made sure to include a lot of documentation, including pictures of those remote controlled valves with the RFID addresses basically written on them and blueprints and the whole shebang. So two articles, provide supporting sort of records and documentation of this would be Water as a Weapon, and then also an article entitled Homeward Bound. And in Homeward Bound, I went a little further and started looking also at some of the supporting legislation that got passed around the time of 2001 that appears to be providing a legal framework to support a project like this. I also looked at some of the players, including Michael Chertoff, who was one of the primary authors of the USA Patriot Act. It's Section 817 of the USA Patriot Act that appears to provide some of the problematic verbiage to support a project of this nature. And then I extended some of the search into some activities of a man named Larry Chertoff. Larry Chertoff is a cousin of Michael Chertoff's and is also one of the top water guys in the country. And I was able actually to get an interview with with Larry Chertoff. This is an interview that ended up being put online, in which he tried to deny that he was a cousin of Michael Church.
Interesting.
It's been established that they are cousins, but he tried to lie about it. And when the issue of the second line was brought up, he fiercely denied that any second line existed anywhere. And then, of course, I sent him blueprints to get his comment, and at that point he shut down and wouldn't respond any further. Mm. So we have a family affair with the Chertoffs. Let's keep genocide in the family. Hmm? And, you know, we have supporting legislation. We have blueprints, you know, to basically support that the systems are currently configured, water systems are currently configured to provide exactly the kind of capability that I'm alleging they do. And we have a couple more recent supports. When the United States of America is a party to the Biological Weapons Convention, and in that capacity, the U.S. is mandated to provide the convention with any changes in domestic legislation and other sorts of biological weapons oriented sort of activities and behavior. And the U.S. failed to notify the United Nations of the changes in the domestic legislation that was included in that Section 817 of the USA Patriot Act, which I referred to mm-hmm. earlier. And the U.S. actually went further than failing to notify the convention. I was at the BWC convention in Geneva, Switzerland in 2011, and actually testified at the convention. And I also went to some side events that were hosted by the United States. And in one side event, a member of the U.S. team, a fellow named Dr. Daniel Gerstein with the Department of Homeland Security, did a PowerPoint presentation about the U.S.'s domestic biological weapons legislation and how great it is. He provided in the PowerPoint presentation the old legislation.
Hmm.
He basically did not provide the very disturbing update that is in Section 817 of the USA Patriot Act, which states in part that the prohibitions contained in this section shall not apply to any duly authorized U.S. government activity. And what this means in a nutshell is that we've got biological weapons laws, but the U.S. government does not have to abide by them.
Hmm.
And I'm going to take a breath.
Yeah.
I've been talking a lot.
Well, that's all right. Yeah, I'm looking at Section 817 here now. I'm going to have to do some reading here. I've been taking a lot of notes as you've been talking to just educate myself as to...
You have to scroll down to find that prohibition. It's at the bottom. It's towards the bottom, and it's a designation C towards the bottom.
See, designation C. Whoever knowingly violates this section shall be fined as provided in this title, imprisoned not more than 10 years or both, but the prohibition contained in this section shall not apply with respect to any duly authorized United States governmental activity.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So if the government authorizes the use of the biological weapons, the guys who carry out these
immunity
activities have immunity.
Immunity, right?
Well.
And I would think that might also extend if anybody were able to isolate what Vujra-Bosan had located that attaches on to melanin and very possibly causes diabetes and hypertension in darker skinned people. If anybody were able to, trot into a court of law with these contentions, apparently that might also dissuade, that also might shut down a lawsuit of that nature.
Mm.
So in other words, the United States government can attack its citizens with biological weapons with immunity, period. That's what it means.
Wow. Well, I will definitely put a link to that in the show notes so that you can read this for yourselves, you listeners and viewers,
right.
To make sure that you understand that this is not, as to use Janet's phrase, not something that she thought up out of her own head, but something that is available in writing, that, hiding in plain sight.
And I discuss this also in my book, Exile. The book, you know, starts off with the approach, romantic approach of Jack Smith, and then goes into, you know, a rather extreme scenario which resulted in my fleeing the U.S. And I just want to very briefly state, I'm talking to you right now from Uruguay. Mm. I was in Mexico from 2010 to the end of May 2016. And my book, Exile, was published in 2014, at which point my situation in Mexico became more fragile. I began to have certain things, kind of upsetting things happening. My home was repeatedly entered without my authorization during my absence. I had some other rather disturbing and obviously governmental Mexican activity around me. I was actually on a bus a couple of times going from one part of Mexico to another, and the federales boarded the bus. They yanked me and only me off the bus, discussed among themselves, wanted me to, you know, empty out my luggage, which was at that point just a backpack, found vitamins, discussed amongst themselves if they could possibly arrest me for having vitamins, decided they couldn't, then wanted me to show them all the money I had in my pockets. I protested they did not have the legal authority to make that request, and they did not. They told, you know, they pointed their guns and basically said I had to, I did,
you know, and they're talking about the authorization
for having too much money, you know. So this began to happen repeatedly. So I went to the Human Rights, Federal Human Rights Office, and tried to file a complaint, and found that the attorney called the police on me. Okay. The federal human rights attorney tried to have me arrested. So things began to get kind of, you know, these are just a couple of instances of what I was dealing with. And it became very challenging. And then just a couple of months before I left Mexico, and I left late May of this year, I had some correspondence with my editor at New Eastern Outlook, in which I told him that I wanted to go back to the BWC in Geneva, Switzerland, the Biological Weapons Convention. They're going to be meeting again in November, and I plan to provide an update and to testify again. And at that point, I will just say that my life exploded in Mexico. Mm. And I left. I closed up my house. I'm still paying rent. And I came to Uruguay, where I have a close friend, and I filed a petition and request for precautionary measures with the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, naming Mexico as abusing my legal and human rights. Mm. So I wanted to mention that very briefly because sure. My situation has become, again, a bit unstable. And
well, it's good to have that information out there. Well, we'll keep you in prayer if there's anything we can do in terms of getting information out for people to – obviously, the more people who know where you are, what you're doing, and what has been happening, the hopefully, presumably, the safer you are. It's when nobody knows what's going on that they can get away with making people disappear.
Well, I'm fairly comfortable here in Uruguay, and I plan to. I think that the filing of the petition may give me the buffer I need to get back to my place in Mexico. Yeah. So I just wanted to mention it because I do think sometimes when people know what's going on,
it does. It's a little better.
It's a good idea.
Yeah. Well, I know we've only scratched the surface of the conversation of this topic, Janet, but in the interest of keeping this to a manageable length for listeners and viewers, I'd like to close here, but let viewers and listeners know where they can find your work and how they can get a copy of your book, Exile.
Yes, I'm currently writing for New Eastern Outlook, and if you just Google that you will find my articles. And they are a geopolitical journal that is published out of Moscow.
Mm-hmm.
I also have Exile is available at thebookpatch.com. You can order it in hard copy or download an ebook. And just about 2 months ago, I had a book of poetry published entitled Held Captive, which is talking about basically it's a concept book of poetry. And the idea is that the world is now basically held captive by dark forces.
That it is.
And this is the perception that has kind of impelled the poems in the book. And that is also available at the book patch.
Well, I'll put links to both of those in the show notes, which you'll find online at vftb.net. Janet Phelan, investigative journalist, temporarily, at least now in Uruguay, and raising topics that are uncomfortable. But when you start investigating the bigger picture here, it fits into the mosaic that... And it's a very disturbing picture. We are, in a sense, behind enemy lines for the time being anyway. Janet, thanks for taking time out of your schedule today, and have a blessed and safe weekend.
Thank you. And thank you so much for the opportunity to appear on your show, Derek. I really appreciate it.
We'll talk again.
Okay.
In the show notes, you'll find a link to Janet's book, Exile, as well as to New Eastern Outlook, where you can find her articles. You'll find those at vftb.net and also the YouTube channel, youtube.com/Derek Gilbert. By the way, the website move for A View from the Bunker, vftb.net, is now complete. The site is about 95% there. There are a few things that I'm still tweaking, but at least we've got all of the archives over, which means all of the video, or rather the audio content, is now available from the new server, the new hosting company. So hopefully we'll be a little more responsive, a little snappier than it's been over the past couple of years. The old hosting company, Bluehost, I'm told that they were purchased by an outside investor. And ever since then, their customer service has really fallen apart. They were great the first few years that we were with them. We were with them, about 6 years. And for the first few years, it was great. But then the last year or so, we've come to realize that when they say unlimited, it doesn't really mean unlimited, and that they had no problems shutting down our websites because we were using too many resources, which is hard to understand when they say that you've got unlimited bandwidth and unlimited storage, how you could run out of resources. So apparently for some hosting companies, unlimited doesn't really mean unlimited. So we're in the middle of transferring our other sites, but also the Gilbert House Fellowship site is moved over, and that is the other important one as far as Sharon and I are concerned. So it looks like from here on out, we'll be able to keep up the speed. The most recent podcast episodes now available also in A View from the Bunker. That is vftb.net. And of course, you'll find us online at the Facebook page as well, facebook.com/viewfromthebunker, where you can share your thoughts about the items that we raise on this program. Used to have comments open on vftb.net, and found that I was spending an awful lot of my time moderating comments. There is a tendency, I think, on the part of many of us to feel a sense of anonymity that allows us to be a little more blunt in our comments when we're sharing them through the internet. And it got to be a lot of non-productive time. And this, by the way, is why Skywatch TV does not have the comments open on the YouTube videos that we post. We just don't have time to moderate. And sadly, this is why we shut down the PID Radio Cafe at Facebook as well, that even among groups of Christians, the enemy is able to use that perceived sense of anonymity that the internet offers us to allow us, to tempt us into rationalizing unchristian behavior towards others, because we think somehow psychologically that we're not really dealing with a real person on the other end of the screen. I can't think of any other way to explain why. And when I say we, I mean we, because I fall into this trap as well. I mean, I was genetically hardwired from birth to be on the debate team in high school and did very well there. Loved debate team. I took debate team as seriously as hardcore football players would take, you know, studying the X's and O's. That was me digging for evidence to use in the debate team, you know, tournaments. But through the internet, you feel free, we feel free to say things or write things that we would never say to another person face to face. And so let's just not, we just, Sharon and I decided not to facilitate that. And again, at Skywatch TV, that's been a policy of Tom Horn's for quite some time. Not just because there are people who aren't friendly to other people, but also because once you get past a certain level, to be quite honest, there are some people who try to hijack, you know, ride coattails. You know, you post something to the internet and someone else will post something saying, hey, if you think this is great, check out my video over here. Yeah. So again, we're just not going to facilitate that. But anyway, if you care to engage, please do so at the Facebook page. You'll find it there, facebook.com/viewfromthebunker. A news item this week that we shared through Skywatch TV. This was a video that just got posted Friday night into Saturday morning, late Friday night, was an update that we received from L.A. Marzulli on that so-called demon fairy or winged nightmare, as L.A. was calling it. This was the thing that can only be described as looking like the proverbial bat out of hell. And there's a reason for that. I'll share that in just a moment. But L.A. called during the week and said, hey, look, I've got breaking news. It's important. Need to get with you on this. They had taken this creature. They'd finally gotten it into their possession. Now, again, he disclosed the existence of this thing in July at the Rocky Mountain International Prophecy Conference. But at that time, they had only seen it once in person when visiting Jaime Masson several years ago at his offices in Mexico City. And after that, all they could do was examine x-rays, the first set of x-rays that were taken in Mexico City of this thing. And they weren't the highest resolution. And so it was difficult to see things that became more clear when they were actually able to examine this thing personally in Los Angeles this past week. In a nutshell, it turns out that it is, in fact, a hoax. It's a composite of two creatures, two bats, basically, that were pieced together by an expert, somebody who's got some expertise in taxidermy, it appears. But as LA describes it, they were examining it with three veterinarians who thought that the thing was real until they had it out of the solution in which it had been soaking for quite some time. Jaime Masson apparently has had this in his possession for about 10 years. It was in an alcohol solution or formaldehyde solution, whatever it was, when the creature, this chimera began to dry, the skin peeled back, and then they were able to see the work of whoever actually assembled this thing out of two bats. Apparently one or both of them perhaps had been shot, which explains the presence of the birdshot in the creature. I don't know why it didn't occur to me or Richard Shaw or L.A. Marzulli or anyone else looking at this thing that maybe this thing hadn't been shot after it was. We couldn't figure out why somebody would assemble a fake and then shoot it to make it authentic. But for some reason, it never occurred to us that somebody assembled this out of animals that had already been shot, and that's why they were dead. But that is what it is. And to his credit, L.A. Marzulli stepped out as soon as they knew that this was a fake and arranged to conduct an interview that we posted at Skywatch TV. It's also on the Skywatch TV channel on Roku now under web exclusives, or Roku exclusives, actually. Also the Skywatch TV channel on YouTube. So you can see after they determined that it was a fake, they actually contacted a zoologist in Santa Barbara. And they made a donation to the museum where the zoologist works to have him determine what animals had been used to create this hoax. You know, and they didn't have to do that, to their credit. Once they determined it was a hoax, they could have just said, well, that's it. We're done with this thing. But they took it a step further to not only determine how it was assembled, but what it was assembled from. And that was the zoologist who determined that it was two ex-bats that had been pieced together and then doctored a bit to create this very realistic-looking phony. But again, I credit L.A. and Richard Shaw, who I believe both of these men are honorable men and want to do the right thing. They're trying to get at the truth of this thing. And it was realistic enough that it fooled Jaime Masson, a guy who's been a paranormal investigator for decades, and three veterinarians who looked at the first set of x-rays. And then in the physical examination, it was only the last 15 minutes, half an hour, you know, they'd been looking at it for a couple of hours, but it was only when the skin began to dry and peel back that it revealed the structure. And then when they looked at the newer x-rays, the better, higher resolution x-rays, that it became obvious. And I show those in the courtesy of Richard Shaw in the video that's at Skywatch TV. You can see the x-ray along with notes added by Richard Shaw pointing out the evidence of the hoax. So it is in fact a fake, but to their credit, LA and Richard jumped out ahead of it to say, look, this is a fake, and this is what we've done in order to document that it's a fake. You will see the footage of the investigation revealing the hoax in the next Watchers film, I expect. I know Richard is working on something right now with the footage that he took at from the investigations this past week. So what surprised me a little bit was some of the responses on Facebook to the video once it was posted. You know, I was a little taken aback at some of the remarks about the character of L.A. Marzulli in coming forward with this. And this gets back to what I mentioned earlier, that perhaps for some of us, we need to take a breath before we hit the return key or click send. He, to his credit, the very day that they found out that this was a hoax this past week, contacted us to set a time to discuss it. And we posted it at Skywatch TV as soon as we were finished with the editing, which we rushed through in order to get it out as soon as possible. I received a couple of questions via email. No, let me just say this. I am certain that LA was not threatened in order to retract anything. But if you were listening carefully when he first presented this in July, and all along he's been saying, we think this is real, but more testing needs to be done. They didn't actually have this creature in their possession until this past week. And that was the more testing. This is the result of the more testing. It was determined that it is not, in fact, real. What's interesting about this is that you rarely hear about the hoaxes perpetrated in the fields of paleontology. The phonies that pass into public consciousness as real, like Piltdown Man, for example. Or the phony early dinosaurs or early proto-birds that are discovered in one particular region in China where the farmers have figured out that they can, if they can put together a few bones and make it look convincing, they can get a nice check from archaeologists who are looking to make their bones as the discoverer of the next missing link in the Darwinian chain. So I just a little surprised that some people are reacting negatively to this response and casting aspersions on a couple of men who I've come to know over the last few years and respect. They're taking a risk. They put themselves out there and take the shots because they're trying to get at the truth of something. And we as Christians, yeah, I'm not saying that we should blindly accept everything that comes down the pike. That's not what I'm saying. We are to be wise as serpents. But the other part of that statement that Jesus left us with is that we're also supposed to be gentle as doves. Well, a couple things that we talk about in the news, but let me just leave you with this one thing, because the other stuff is material that Sharon and I will probably cover in this coming week's Sci Friday. But one element that we did talk about on Sci Friday this week that I thought was important, and why we titled the episode The Guardians of Reality, is that our reality is in fact shaped by the internet. And what we need to remember is that anything that we're absorbing from the internet is curated for us. Whether we're using Google, Bing, Yahoo, or any other search engine, to an extent, those results are curated. Maybe not by a human, but by an algorithm, certainly. Now, you may remember there was the big hoopla earlier this year about Facebook and its human news curators who were deciding what would go in the trending box on the right-hand column at Facebook, which is supposed to be stories that people in your sphere of influence, your circle of friends and colleagues were discussing. And it turned out that that was not in fact the case, that Facebook editors were deciding that stories that supported a liberal or progressive narrative were more likely to receive top billing in the trending box than stories that were being shared between conservatives. Well, last week, Friday, now we're talking a week ago, Friday, Facebook fired its human editors. They let them all go. And they turned over the curation of the stories in the trending box to an algorithm. And lo and behold, we found that almost immediately, phony stories were appearing at the top of the trending box, because that's what was being shared back and forth between people on Facebook. There's a lesson to be learned from that, which is, number one, don't believe everything you read. And number two, maybe you shouldn't be getting your news from Facebook in the first place. But Facebook this week, along with Twitter and news organizations like the French press agency, I'd call it AFP and spell that out, except, you know, 7 years of French in high school and college, and I still can't say anything except je m'appelle Derek. Agence, no, I'm not even going to say it. AFP, the French press agency, YouTube, New York Times, Washington Post, BuzzFeed News, CNN, ABC News of Australia, ProPublica, The Telegraph, France Info, Le Monde, Breaking News, International Business Times from the UK. They've formed a coalition that they call First Draft News, and their stated goal is to filter out online misinformation and improve news quality on social networks. The idea here, I think there are a couple of messages here. First of all, is that the former gatekeepers are upset that the gate is moved. Okay, the gatekeepers of the official story are upset that there is no more gate, or the gate is moved, and that other sources of online journalism, Breitbart for one, Drudge for another, really popular bloggers. There are a number that I look at on a daily basis to find out what is really going on. One of the best sites I find for important news, a mix of political and economic news, is Zero Hedge, zerohedge.com. Sources like that, and of course I understand they're curated as well. They're curated as well. It's just they're pulling together things you wouldn't normally find elsewhere. But Skywatch TV, even the Skywatch TV website, Tom Horn, pulls together news items about three times a week that are available on the internet, but not normally in one place, and certainly not with the type of analysis that Tom would add to it. And there are other sites out there like End Times Headlines or Now the End Begins, where you can find news, but filtered and analyzed from a Christian perspective, especially with a biblical prophetic perspective. And the former keepers of the gate, New York Times, Washington Post, et cetera, are a little miffed that we are not trusting them to filter out the news for us. And so that's how they're getting together with Facebook and Twitter and so forth to improve online journalism and filter out misinformation. So again, two things here. The professional journalists are upset that a new generation of internet journalists are basically making it very difficult for them to control the official narrative anymore. And secondly, going forward, they're going to make it more difficult for us, for you and me, to trust what we read. Again, don't believe everything you read. With every story, even the stuff I bring you, don't necessarily believe it because I say it. With any story, ask, who benefits? Who benefits? And why is this news coming out now? Question the timing, question the motive, no matter the source. For me personally, I do not want professional journalists or government overseers determining what is true on my behalf. Let me filter it out. Let me use my brain. As a Christian, that's what I've been called to do. Love the Lord with my heart, my soul, and my mind. Christians, let's not settle for 2 out of 3. Coming up on A View from the Bunker, we've got interviews that I hope will continue in this to provoke thought. Jeff Kinley, Joseph Farah, two more interviews as part of our exclusive series from the Rocky Mountain International Prophecy Conference. Both of them gave presentations there in July. You'll hear those interviews coming up this week, Wednesday, the 21st. Next Sunday, a gentleman whose work I stumbled across as I was researching my presentation for the Rocky Mountain Prophecy Conference. Richard Burke, who writes under the name R.E.J. Burke, he's written a 6-book series of novels called Raising Up Pharaoh. And he's done an awful lot of research into the archaeology and the history of the ancient world, going back to the prehistoric ancient Near East, the Ubaid culture, the Uruk culture, which would be the culture of Nimrod, and then the periods just following that. And we had a fascinating discussion about some of the more mysterious aspects of those cultures. Like, why did they make all those little lizard-like, humanoid lizard-like figurines? And why were they found concentrated in an area around a temple devoted to Enki, the god of the earth, whose home was in the Abzu beneath his temple? The Abzu, by the way, is the word from which we get the abyss. So, god of the abyss, little lizard-like figurines in the period immediately following, or what would have been immediately following, the expulsion from Eden. So that interview coming up on September 25th. On the 28th, from the Rocky Mountain International Prophecy Conference, two deep thinkers whose work I really appreciate. Brent Miller Sr. and our good friend Carl Tykrib. Those interviews on October 2nd, and then September 28th, October 2nd, Carl Tykrib talks about the recent Burning Man Festival and other transformational festivals like it. Though that's the upcoming schedule on A View from the Bunker. Now, I'm trying to keep to a Wednesday-Sunday schedule. You'll forgive me if we've been a little delayed because of the website transfer. I'm also finding that by producing these as videos as well as just audio, that the rendering time on the videos, and it's probably the way I'm editing and composing the videos, I'm making files that are probably much too big, like this file I'm shooting right now in HD, 720p. But it's going to be crushed down to about 25% of the screen size to fit into the little box that you're watching this on, if you're watching this on the YouTube channel. So I probably don't need to make as big a video file for these interviews as I've been doing. And that's leading to a rendering time for a one-hour interview that runs like 5-6 hours. So some of these interviews scheduled for Sunday evening are going up Monday morning, and the Wednesdays are going up Thursdays, but we're trying to get back to it and keep to a better schedule. And it will help now that we've got the majority of our websites moved over to the new hosting company. That will make things a lot easier. Speaking of which, the Gilbert House Fellowship will be back on Sunday. We were offline this past week because of the transfer. That's done. GilbertHouse.org is back online. So Sunday you'll find two new Bible studies, one Old Testament, one New Testament, as we go through the Bible in chronological order, posted by midday Sunday. And on Monday, another video, our video audiobook. Yes, the video audiobook. It's an audiobook, but I'm releasing it through YouTube. The next episode in The God Conspiracy, my novel, supernatural thriller, released Monday morning, 9 a.m. Central Time. You'll find it at youtube.com/Derek Gilbert. And by the way, I'd sure appreciate it if you would subscribe and then share that video around. Skywatch TV this coming week, the third week of three with Rabbi Jonathan Kahn discussing his new book, The Book of Mysteries. I'm really glad that Josh Peck was there. Well, I'm really glad when Sharon or Josh, anyway, I've got a co-host with me on these interviews, because there come times when the brain just misfires and gaps out, and it seems like they're always there with a better question than I would have asked, too. And Josh really steps up and helps out in the interviews with Rabbi Kahn. But those interviews will be released beginning tomorrow morning, actually. I think the first play is in Sandusky, Ohio, but all next week you'll find it coast to coast on various networks, the Victory Television Network, the Cornerstone Network, the Christian Television Network, World Harvest Television, the complete schedule posted at skywatchtv.com. In the top menu bar there, click the link that says channels. We appreciate your reviews of A View from the Bunker. You'll find us on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever else good podcasts are, well, not sold, but distributed. And check us out again on Facebook. Give us a like there. Facebook.com/viewfromthebunker. A View from the Bunker is a production of Gilbert House, released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives 4.0 International License. The opening theme is by Kevin MacLeod. His website is incompetech.com. Remember, we wrestle not against flesh and blood. I'm Derek Gilbert, and this is A View from the Bunker.